This podcast was brought to you by Wildflowers and Sangha in partnership with Zen Sangha Belgium. This Dharma talk was given by Roshi Amy Hollowell.
Thank you very much, Frank Roshi, for this invitation. And thank you to the Zen Sangha Belgium for hosting me, and to each of you for inviting me into your homes for this morning, Saturday morning. It's my pleasure to be here as well. Some of the faces I recognize, you know, a few of you I've seen throughout the years when I have been in Ghent or when we've been at other retreats in Belgium, and then the Dana, Greater Dana retreats that we've done. It's great to see some of the faces again. Also, I see some of my students. I'm very happy that they came to share this bigger Sangha moment. And thank you for hosting, inviting us all here today. So, when Frank asked me for a title of something that I would talk about, I don't usually think in terms of titles and planning much in advance for my teshos, but it's a good practice. I appreciate the invitation to do that. And so I came up with a title, and then he wanted an image, a picture. I didn't know what to send. And so I just took a page out of my notebook, which is the image that was shared with on the website, the Zen Sangha website, and also in the mailing that Wildflower Sangha did, inviting all of our members to come. And I chose that page because it relates to one of the great images of the Buddha that we have, and one of the stories from his, from the myths of the Buddha's life and awakening, when he is challenged in the dark night of his soul by Mara, and he is thrown any number of temptations, and he points to the ground and calls the earth as his witness, he says. That's how the official story goes. For me, this story is a little different. It's the same story, but it's just my experiential interpretation of it is different. Different words, of course, and different moment, because as we know, Zen is always about here and now and you. So, and what we can call the four conditions, you know, the time, the place, the people, the amount. And so for me, this moment of the earth as my witness was actually in the early days, the first months that we were living in the Dana house with Frank and Geno Roshi and my partner and one of our former Dharma, she's still our Dharma sister, but she's no longer practicing, Dorota. And my son, who was a baby, had just been born. And my daughter was six. And we were all trying to do this experiment together, having a house that we all lived in, and upstairs a zendo, which some of you know, which Frank and I, Frank with his hands, me less with my hands, but with my presence, helped create and build and establish, so that all of these years later, almost 30 years later, people are still practicing and living there. So in those early days when I had two small children, it was difficult for me. I also had a job that I went to part-time, but still it was, you know, I had to devote my time and energy to that. And my children and my partner and my practice and my teacher. So it was a lot. So one morning, because I could not practice with everyone else in Zendo in the morning, I had to feed my child, get her up, take her to school, come home, deal with the baby, while everyone else was in the Zendo. And then everyone else went off and did what they were doing in the day. And so I had to sit by myself in my room, if I was going to sit at all, when the baby went down for a nap. The baby is now 25 years old and much taller than me and living his life. But at the time he was, I had to be there with him. And so I'm sitting there one morning in my room, staring at the wall. In those days, we faced the wall. And the baby's behind me, sleeping on my bed. And I'm just feeling so sorry for myself. Feeling so left out. Feeling like, poor me. Everyone else can do what they want. Everyone else can practice together. Everyone else is in the heart of it all. And I'm, you know, sitting here with a baby in my room alone. And the fire trucks are going by outside and the cars, and I can hear everybody else in the house doing their things. And at some point something happened, you know, the baby coughed or something. And suddenly I realized, oh, this is my practice. This, I am in the heart of my practice. My practice is not up there in the Zendo. My practice is not in the next room with my teacher. My practice is not going off to every retreat that my teacher leads. Of course, it is that too. But at this moment, this was my practice. And it was as if suddenly that image of the Buddha touching the ground was, oh yeah, I got it. It's this. It's right here. This is the ground of awakening. This is the throne of enlightenment. This right here. My life as it is, the baby sleeping, smelly diaper, crying, feeling sorry for myself. That's it. And this was life-changing for me because it meant that I was always in the heart of my own practice. I was never excluded from my practice. I could not be. The only way I could be excluded from my practice was if I told myself I was excluded from my practice. And so all of these temptations of Mara throwing up, you should be somewhere else. You should be someone else. You should do something else. You should go somewhere else. You should feel something else. All of that. I said, Mara, it's here, right here. This is it. On the blue carpet, facing this white wall in my room in 22 Avenue Pasteur on a Tuesday morning. Now, the funny thing is that I chose to go live in the house. Of course, I didn't formulate it in this way, but to realize that. I wanted to make my practice my life, and I wanted to make my life my practice. And I said that, but I didn't really know what that meant. But intuitively, I said that. And it was so powerful that I couldn't resist, even though, the conditions seemed like it would be impossible. And I asked my teacher when I found out that I had already made plans to go live in the house with my already 5-year-old daughter, which Roshi Geno Roshi accepted. And then I found out I was pregnant and I thought, oh, no way. She's not going to let me come now. No way. And I was really worried about that. And so I finally got up the courage to tell her. And this was about the time that Maizumi Roshi had died. And so she had other things on her mind, and the house was being built and all of this stuff. But I found a moment and I told her, and I was afraid she was going to say, oh, okay, well, we'll find someone else to take that room. Sorry, but we can't do it. But she said, oh, no. Or she said, oh, yes, you know, how wonderful. Of course you can come and live in the house. It will help us all to be creative. Now, this time I wept with gratitude. It will help us all to be creative. What an amazing thing to say. You know, this was a daring thing because she was coming from a very different environment. She was coming from a monastic environment where people gave up their jobs, they left their countries, much like Frank Roshi did. They left everything, their homes, everything, and went to live in the community and devoted themselves to practice formal, what we call formal practice, 24/7. And she said, how wonderful. This will help us all to be creative. And the thing was that I was also leaving everything. I was also leaving my home, my life as I had known it. I was, of course, bringing my children with me plunging into this unknown. Because somewhere I knew that was what it was about, that it was not about leaving things, but about including things. At the time, I couldn't formulate it that way, but I knew it intuitively. And the message that our teacher was giving us was that as well. The very fact of the community that she was choosing to build was the message, because she expected us all to work. Everyone had to work to pay. We weren't living there for free. Frank Roshi, he had, in a sense, he had a much harder time than me because he had left his work in Belgium and he had to figure out how to earn his right livelihood in Paris, in a new environment, and call upon his many skills. He says, I have many talents. Well, he does too, actually. And he called upon them. He found so many skillful means to provide, to support his practice. And that's what Roshi expected of us. Not because it was doctrine or she had an idea about it, because that was the situation we were in. That was the ground. And so if we were pointing to the ground and saying, this is the ground of awakening, well, we had to be there. We had to show up on that ground. We had to fully embody that ground. And that was what she demanded of us. We were, I think, all willing clients. We all believed in her entirely and whatever she, you know, whatever she proposed and however she was choosing to, whatever her teaching was, we, in French, we would say adhéré. We followed it. We trusted her and she trusted us. So when I gave this title of this talk, Into the Heart of the World, I was basically, it's what I teach all the time. It's what I embody. You know, I often say to my students, you know, I'm offering you my life as a teaching. I'm offering you everything I am and do as a teaching. When I mess up, when I make mistakes, when I don't show up, teaching. When I do show up, when I am there for you, when you hear something I say that has meaning for you, when we're together and we chant, when we share Orioki, when we sit together, when we work together, or when we're sitting together in the Zoom Zendo on the screen, I'm offering myself as a teaching. I have nothing else to offer, in fact. There is nothing else. And so what I mean by into the heart of the world is that what the teaching is, what this image of the Buddha is, it's he's calling us to go into the heart of the world. That's what's the beauty of Zen practice, is it's not a practice of withdrawing. It's a practice of engaging, of plunging in, of opening, of including, of taking that step off of the 10,000 foot pole. Of not knowing, you know, of accepting the mystery of the uncertainty. And as soon as we step away from that mystery of the uncertainty, we find ourselves stuck, you know? And then we hear Mara calling. I'm just using that image of Mara, who I don't really ever think about, but it's an appropriate image because I'm talking about this ground of awakening image. Because when we start drifting from that ground, when we start drifting from here, we lose touch with who we truly are, what is truly here. And that drifting can be having an idea about what is here, of an idea about who we are. It can be grasping for something, to hang on to something from the past, or projecting to hope to get something in the future. In which case we miss just the ground as it is right here. It's frightening though, to step into that mystery of not knowing. When I say, okay, in that moment, I realized that my life as it is the ground of awakening. This place right here is the ground of awakening. There is some fear in that too, because that means, oh, I have to do it here, you know? I have to show up here. Am I willing to show up here? Am I willing to do this? Am I willing to make everything as my life practice and my practice my life? Letting it all in. And the thing is, we don't know what all of that is, right? And another page from my notebook that I could have given, but I didn't, because I thought this one was more appropriate. Maybe I could just show it in front of the camera. I don't know if it's visible. This one is, do you see it backwards or you see it? Is it like in a mirror or is it appropriate? So this one is vast emptiness, nothing holy. And it also has all of these lines from Allen Ginsberg's poem. From his poem Howl, he has this, you can find it on the internet actually, you can hear him chanting it, where it's just holy, 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 holy. Everything is holy, everybody's holy, everywhere is holy, every day is eternity, every man's an angel. Holy hours, bodies, sufferings. Holy forgiveness, mercy, charity, faith. Holy time in eternity. Holy eternity in time. Holy the clocks in space. Holy the supernatural, extra brilliant, intelligent kindness of the soul. And then he also has, you know, holy the my mother in the insane asylum, holy the dirt, holy everything. He goes on and names holy, holy, holy. So how could we have Buddy Dharma saying nothing holy, and yet we have Allen Ginsberg reverently chanting holy, holy, holy? It's the same thing. If we can see that everything is holy, if we can trust, so when we say we trust the mystery means not knowing, it means not making any choices or solutions, not seeking to resolve it, not seeing to make categories of what is holy and what isn't, then we can truly appreciate everything as it is. And we can truly see the holiness of everything. Then we can truly see the holiness and the sacredness of this ground where you are sitting, which is the holy ground of your awakening. And the beauty of it is it's organic. I'm suddenly realizing, you know, I'm chattering away here in English, and I don't know how much of that is, you know, how much of that you can process, because it's my native language and I'm really sorry that I can't speak in yours. And I don't know if you often hear talks in English. Frank Roshi, do they? No, I can't hear you. But...
Every now and then we do, like okay. These last months a little bit more regular.
Okay. You know, I happen to, you know, belong to the Imperial English language caste, and so that's the language that I can speak. So I could have done French, but I think that would have been even less accessible, especially for my Portuguese students, that would have been less. You know, if I could speak Portuguese and Flemish and French and English all at once, that would be maybe the best, but I can't. And German and Spanish for Ariane, who's in Spain, but of course Ariane speaks English. So in any case, holy, sacred, in whatever language you speak, I encourage you to look into it and see what it is. What does that mean? So I was saying, when we move away from that, when we move away from this ground that is ours, then we lose contact with the holiness, the wholeness, which is also, which, you know, kind of works in English, whole and holy. We start moving towards separation and differentiation. And then we have more difficulty responding to the situation at hand. Of course, we also lose the notion of interdependence and interconnection. When we move away, it seems like a paradox that when we stay connected with our ground, we would be better connected with the others. And it seems like if we move away from our ground, we would be better connected, but we're not. You know, there's this fascinating thing that is happening in the Suez Canal. I don't know how many of you have heard of this, where there's this boat, this enormous boat that, in the American press, they keep saying, is longer than the Empire State Building is tall. Because for Americans, the Empire State Building is this huge skyscraper in New York. It's long. This is a big boat. And it's stuck. It ran aground. I haven't read all of the details, but from what I've heard, there was a dust storm. You know, this very natural phenomenon that occurs in that part of the world. Desert, right? And for some reason, that threw everything out of whack, and the boat ran aground, and they can't get it up. They can't get it unstuck. Which means, which we could say, okay, fine, there's a boat stuck in the Suez Canal. But the implications of that are the karmic, this is a huge karmic example of cause and effect, right? The effects of that are so, we can't even fathom them, how big this is in our lives, because so much of what we have from, you know, this iPhone to, you know, maybe even this pen arrives on ships like that through the Suez Canal. And it's not only objects, but there are animals, there's livestock. And there are hundreds of boats now in both directions, which can't go through. And nobody really knows what to do, except they're trying to figure out how to get it out. And I haven't been following the technical thing, but it's stuck. We're trying to figure out how to get it out. Some of the boats are backing up and are choosing to go down the coast of Africa and around the Cape of Good Hope, which seems to us a huge detour, right? You know, we get annoyed when we're in the city and there's a detour. Can you imagine that? And some of the boats, apparently, they can't go back to their ports of origin because of COVID restrictions. The animals, they don't, you know, what are they going to do with these animals? How long can they live on there? A lot of complications. So this is a reflection of our interdependence and our interconnection, right? Of how connected we are. The whole COVID pandemic has been another one. It's also a reflection of when we move away from our ground, when we start, instead of using the ingredients that are at hand and working with in our communities organically, we move farther and farther away. And so the ingredients and the labor and the resources are nowhere near our ground. Far, far, far away. You know, a lot of these products, as we know, are produced in just dire, dire circumstances in Bangladesh or Vietnam and China. And this is a choice we've made. For what reason? Well, it usually has to do with profit. It usually has to do with immediate happiness and objects and obtaining and acquiring, instead of staying close to our ground and appreciating what we have where we are. Instead of responding to the mystery of this wild place in which we find ourselves, we look elsewhere and we seek something that is other than here. Now, what's interesting about that is, there's I read recently about this study at Harvard, which has been going on for more than 70 years and is now run by a guy who's a Zen priest, actually, a Zen teacher. I looked him up because I'd never heard of him before, and he's from, it looks like he's a successor of Melissa Blacker, Well, I think you know Frank Roshi, right? Yeah. Or he has something to do with her lineage in any case. And, but he's a professional, you know, doctor in psychology or something. And so he's the one who's in charge of the study at the moment. And the study is about happiness. And they chose, originally they chose 250 men, boys who were students at Harvard 75 years ago, and followed them throughout their life. Some of them are still alive. Some of them, most of them have, I think there's only about 20 of them who are still alive. One of them, among them at the time, in the original study, was John Kennedy, who became president of the United States. And then they expanded it at one point to have people from other walks of life instead of these white privileged males. But all men, they're all men, actually. And in it, the upshot is that what they've discovered is that happiness is not what we think it is. That the people who are the happiest in this study are the ones who have social interaction, who have relationships, even if, you know, it's a marriage that you argue all the time with your partner, but you still, you know, you're there for each other and you love each other. People who are not lonely, and if they are lonely, they go and they, you know, work in a volunteer situation where they speak with other people who are lonely. They visit people who are lonely, or they, you know, they work, they offer workshops for people who are lonely, or I'm just using lonely as a big term. But, and that it was always about seeking, the happiness came from seeking something bigger than themselves. This is not the same thing as seeking something outside of myself, something other than me. This is about opening to the and I mention this because in this seeking, you know, an iPhone, a better car, another job, becoming something else, it's coming from this same place of seeking something bigger than just me, just me. But it, in the I would say the deluded way of seeking to acquire and obtain, it's coming from a place of not appreciating who you truly are and not seeing who you truly are. But when we can connect with who we truly are, we realize that I am much bigger than who I think I am. And this something bigger than me, this mystery, is not a frightening mystery. It's rich. It's a rich, beautiful mystery that's as big as the sky and as ungraspable as the sky, that I manifest here in my life as I am, but so do you, so does everyone else. And that's where, if we can connect from our heart of being who we truly are with other hearts, that's where happiness lies. And it's not happiness like we think of happiness. It doesn't mean we don't suffer. It doesn't mean we don't have troubles, you know. As many of you know, I've been dealing with COVID for a year now. Last year at this time, I was in bed with COVID and I was really, really sick. And I still have symptoms. I actually got COVID again in the fall, but and I still have, I'm one of these long haul COVID people. But that doesn't mean that I can't experience this very basic happiness, which is not happiness of, oh yeah, I love this situation. I want to do this forever and ever. It's that I know this is the ground. This is my life as it is. And these are my ingredients. And there's nothing wrong with them. There's nothing, of course, I would like to not have trouble sleeping, or I would like to have better circulation in my legs or whatever it is, but that's what it is. And so what my choice is, okay, do I, like it was when I was sitting there in my room with my baby, do I cry and feel sorry for myself and say I'm cut off from the rest of the world? Or do I enter into this? You know, we talk about the gateless gate. Well, the predicament you find yourself in is the gate. Your life situation is the gate. So my sitting there with my baby sleeping in dirty diaper, that's the gate. Today, you know, COVID, that's the gate. For all of us, you know, in our various countries that we live in, we have varying degrees of lockdown and vaccinations. And I talk to my family in the United States and everybody's vaccinated. Even my nieces who are college students and, you know, everybody. I don't know very many people in France who are vaccinated. And I'm nowhere near the level where I can get vaccinated. So do I feel sorry for myself? Do I say, oh, you know, and, you know, be mad at my family because they're all vaccinated in the US? No. You know, can I have what we call mudita, shared joy, and be happy for them? I'm relieved that my mother is vaccinated. I'm relieved that my sisters don't have to be anxious about this situation in the same way as I am, maybe, although I'm in a different way because I'm in a different situation. But, I'm looking at this screen and there are too many people to fit even on. We have three screens on my computer. We have three screens full of people. Debbie is saying goodbye. Thank you for coming, Debbie. Have a good day.
Thank you so much for this.
And I know that many of you know Debbie because she also frequents the, she's kind of a Sangha hopper. I mean, not really. She pretty much comes to two or three sanghas. But, Into the Heart of Life is, enter that gate of where you are. Respond to the mystery of it right now. Again, I come back to that notion of being willing to go there and to open to it, in our practice, we use koans, and koans are about that. Your life is the koan, you know, Genjo koan. Your life is that. The conditions of your life as it is will always be happening as they are. Sometimes the Tibetan thing is you can, what are you going to do? Are you going to pave the world with soft grass or something so you can walk barefoot? Or are you going to wear shoes? You know? So the conditions aren't going to change. They might. I mean, they will. Of course, they will change. But it's what's important is how you sit there, how you walk there, how you stand there, how you... Our practice allows us to walk through those conditions, to be in those conditions, because koans invite us to do that. Koans like give us this enormous opening to value not knowing. to say, okay, I'm sitting here on this chair and this is it, but I don't know what that means. Well, you won't know until you look. You won't know until you plunge. And it's wild. That's why my sangha is called the Wildflower Sangha, because wildflowers, we never know where they will appear. We never know what they will look like. They're always related to the environment in which they grow. If the conditions aren't appropriate, they don't grow. But they will find where the conditions are appropriate, they'll be there. So maybe it's probably time for a break, no? And then come back and you can ask questions or something. Is that right, Frank Roshi? Is that what we're doing?
Yeah, thank you very much. Also for concluding with this beautiful image of the wildflower. So let's take a 10-minute break and then come back and then we can ask questions or share things with Amy Roshi. So let's be back at 12:28 and then we can spend some time together, questions and answers.
If you have enjoyed this Dharma talk, just give us a visit on wildflowerzen.org.